The TV Morning Show is a national programming form that began 60 years ago this week with the debut of a program that's still around and has long been dominant, the Today Show on NBC. But yesterday, CBS went back to the drawing board and revamped its own morning show, coming up with new hosts, a new set, and a new focus. More hard news, less soft entertainment. Our TV critic David Biancooley has watched the first 2 days of CBS This Morning and has this review.
There are three new hosts of CBS This Morning, which was unveiled yesterday. One is Erica Hill, a holdover from the early show, the previous program in the early morning time slot. Another is Gail King, still best known as Oprah Winfrey's best friend, who's here to handle most of the entertainment interviews. And the third, the pivot point, is Charlie Rose, brought over from PBS to give this new show an injection of instant respectability and seriousness. But not even Charlie Rose can sell everything, including the show's new opening 90-second wrap-up of news and feature footage.
But first, as we do every morning, we begin with a look at today's eye-opener, your world in 90 seconds.
As we do every morning? Counting today, you've been on the air twice. Traditions take a little longer to establish than that. Willard Scott saluting 100th birthdays? Now that's a tradition. But the first hour of CBS This Morning, in 2 days, has shown one thing already. It wants to take a little longer to cover stories, and cover them from more than just one angle. On today's show, political correspondent Jan Crawford reported on Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney's widely quoted statement about liking to fire people, but made sure to put both the remark and the resultant publicity in context.
It was all about Mitt Romney, even when he bashed President Obama's health care reform law, saying people should have freedom to dump their insurance companies and choose another one if they wanted, a standard Republican line.
It means that if you don't like what they do, you can fire them. I like being able to fire people who provide services to me. If someone doesn't give me the good service I need, I want to say that I'm going to go get somebody else to provide that service to me.
But all his rivals heard was this.
I like being able to fire people.
That line about insurance companies, taken completely out of context, became the moment of the day.
Then, within minutes, Charlie Rose was talking to CBS Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer and broached the same subject with him. Schieffer was comfortable enough with Rose and honest enough to chuckle about it.
Let me talk about New Hampshire. And we have seen upsets before in New Hampshire. Hillary Clinton, 4 years ago. Is anything happening on the ground that might surprise us?
Well, other than Mitt Romney looking for every way he can to try to lose and drive down his percentage of victory. I mean, yesterday, this I like to fire people. I mean, I guess the only thing worse you could say is in a time like this when people are out of work is that Herbert Hoover is my hero or something like that. I mean, it just boggles the mind. I mean, you know, his people are saying it was taken out of context. But, you know, when people are out of work, there are certain words you just avoid, and saying I like to fire people is one of them, whatever context that was taken in, and coming on the heels of saying a couple of times in my life I worried about getting a pink slip. You know, I mean, this is a multimillionaire who's the son of a multimillionaire. I think people here, who try to go from paycheck to paycheck, wondering if that might be absolutely true.
In the early days and weeks and even months of a new talk or morning show, it takes a while to discover what's right. It's what's wrong that jumps out at you right away. And the only thing that jumps out immediately in a bad way about CBS This Morning is that the approach, especially in Hour 2, isn't quite as serious or as hard news-oriented as it might be. Here's Gail King introducing one of today's segments.
The most beautifulest thing in this world.
That's a brand new song called Glory, written by Jay-Z to express his joy over his newborn daughter, Blue, with Beyonce. But the song reveals that Beyonce had a miscarriage in the past. And as you know, that's a tough subject for a lot of women to talk about, and we're talking about it today.
The real test, I suppose, will come soon, when CBS starts rolling out its primetime reality shows. It's Big Brothers, it's Survivors. In the past, those shows' losers have been paraded out the next day on CBS's morning show. In the future, if they aren't, then maybe the network really is serious about being serious. But being serious and smart doesn't mean you can't do feature stories. Elsewhere on CBS, 60 Minutes has been mixing hard and soft news brilliantly for decades. Now there's a TV tradition. And even NBC's newest attempt at a primetime magazine, Rock Center with Brian Williams, covers both ends of the spectrum very well. In its first show of the new year, Brian Williams presented a wonderful little story about the cleanup crew at Times Square, whose work began as soon as the ball dropped on New Year's Eve. And to mark the transition, the NBC report selected the best possible music cue.
And so here we go, all of us, into the breach with the men of Sector 3 of the New York City Department of Sanitation as they made a clean sweep of the remnants of 2011.
Strongest. This is what we do. It's our turn now. Let's get in there and clean these streets. Let's go.
Later, the piece topped even that piece of music by catching two street sweepers singing a late-night Times Square a cappella version of what else? New York, New York.
I want to wake up in a city that never sweeps.
I love it. And if this push for more serious TV news shows, a push that includes the CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley, Rock Center, and now CBS This Morning, is indeed a trend, count me in.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
One of the most popular shows on cable television returns tonight to the network BET. The Game is about the people who really run pro football, the players' wives and girlfriends. NPR's Netta Ulaby says the creator of The Game is a Hollywood rarity.
Mara Brock-Akil is Black, Muslim, and a mother of two. She's been one of television's most powerful women since 2000, when she created a show that ran on UPN, then the CW network, for 8 years.
I'm going for coffee with Stan.
Oh, I know all about that kind of coffee. Strong, black, and hot.
Girlfriends was about a group of smart, funny women who talked about everything from Zora Neale Hurston to men. Well, mostly men. Mara Brock-Akil started working in television soon after graduating from Northwestern University and realized her fellow writers were missing something.
I started by like, well, I don't think a woman would say that. You know, I don't think that's really our experience, or it's not every woman's experience. It really started with that. Then I was like, well, I don't think that, like, hey, wait a minute, where is a black woman in this story?
Black women are the heart of The Game. The main character is a medical student. Her boyfriend is a rookie wide receiver on an NFL team. He coaches her through exams.
Baby, you need to know this stuff. You getting through med school is all we have to fall back on if this football thing doesn't work out. So, come on, girl. You still might be able to save your patient.
Viral meningitis.
That's my girl!
Yes!
But here's the catch. His success depends on how well she fits in with a smug sorority of football wives.
Isn't your man a third-string wide receiver?
Yeah.
Why are you even talking?
Glamour and wealth are part of The Game's allure. But it's also about families, the sport's intense physical danger, and pro football's stew of race and class.
Oftentimes you'll see that I hit the stereotype dead on.
Come on, Malik. It's only 30 seconds left in the game. Don't do anything stupid.
The stereotype of a lot of athletes are they come from the ghetto, they buy their mama a house, they're loud and audacious.
But Mara Brock-Akil wants to create relatable characters, not cartoons. And she mixes in topical issues, like a player on the down low. When he comes out as gay, one teammate is horrified and needs to get talked down by the light-skinned captain.
Who was discriminated against before the quiz? Us, dude.
Football players?
African-Americans, idiot. Gay rights are no different than civil rights.
You know what? That'd be a lot more convincing if you were darker.
The Game aired on the CW for 3 seasons. Then it got canceled.
It was very humbling for me. I'm a winner, so to speak, meaning even if it doesn't look like I'm winning, I believe I'm winning. But that time, it was kind of rough.
But then something happened that almost never happens. BET took on The Game. TV critic James Poniewozik says the show drew almost 8 million people when it started its 4th season.
That outdraws most of the regular run programming on NBC on any night, you know, excepting maybe football. Maybe it helps that The Game has football involved in it, although, you know, that also didn't help Friday Night Lights.
The Game is not a critical darling like Friday Night Lights, but Poniewozik appreciates the perspective it brings. The Game's mainly directed by Salim Akil, Mara Brock-Akil's husband. Last year, they surprised many in Hollywood with a hit movie.
Mom, this is Sabrina.
Oh, hello.
Jumping the Broom, like so much of the Akils' work, explores race and class. Mara Brock-Akil says she and her husband brainstorm while they're driving around.
You just go for a ride, and we just start talking, and, you know, I was thinking, and then next thing you know, you have this incredible character or a series or a movie idea or whatever, and it really happens a lot just driving around, grab a coffee, grab a tea.
Mixing the serious with the silly is Mara Brock-Akil's stock and trade. But she has yet to write a character who shares her deeply felt Muslim faith.
It has to be the right moment, the right character at the right time. And I do think it's coming close.
First, though, the Akils are remaking the movie Sparkle from 1976 that's loosely based on the story of the Supremes. Then a new TV show about black women and marriage. Mara Brock-Akil says there's a powerful conversation to have about that topic, and she says TV is a powerful way for her to lead it. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Most of us think of YouTube as a place where you spend a few minutes, get a few laughs, and encounter the unexpected.
Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you.
I love you. I love you.
I love you.
Good girl.
I love you.
I love you.
I love you.
I love you. Good girl.
I love you.
Good girl. I love you. Say, I love you.
Memorable. But YouTube may be changing, and in a big way. These days, our internet watching experiences are very different from our TV viewing. We'll enjoy short, grainy videos on computers, but spend hours in the living room with the TV set. As technology changes in coming years, though, TV sets will offer internet content just as easily as cable or broadcast TV. And internet content providers like YouTube can compete for big audiences and big advertising dollars. So YouTube, which is owned by Google, is preparing to launch dozens of professionally produced channels with specialized content they hope will appeal to millions of people. John Seabrook writes about YouTube's ambitious plans in the current issue of The New Yorker. John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. Well, John Seabrook, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
You know, a long time ago, there were, you know, the three major networks which could produce television, which got a huge national audience. And then cable came along and fragmented, you know, the TV viewing audience. And we also saw, you know, more narrowly focused channels, food channels, a history channel, shopping channels, you know, fishing channels. Does YouTube think there's a market for even narrower niches?
Yes, they definitely do. I mean, they see the Asian channel, for example, which there doesn't really exist on cable, or an Asian sitcom, or a transgender channel, or a cricket channel, or a horseback riding channel. There are a lot of sports and pastimes that have a large group of people interested in them, but they're not necessarily based in one country. And one of the unique things about YouTube is that it's global. So you can put together an audience of cricket lovers from many countries around the world and achieve a pretty large audience. But if you just tried to do that in one country, you'd get a fairly small audience. So YouTube allows you to kind of aggregate these disparate audiences in various countries and put them together into one pretty good-sized chunk.
Right. And they're going to be, you know, commissioning, you know, professional performers or content developers to make stuff for them. Who are they asking to produce channels?
Well, you know, over the last year, they've held kind of a sweepstakes. The word went out. It was an open secret. YouTube wouldn't confirm it officially, but a lot of people got approached by YouTube in many different media, print, TV, movies, music, dance. And YouTube offered kind of book publishing style advances of several million dollars to people who were professional content creators who were willing to make content for one of these new YouTube channels. And they got something like 1,000 people who submitted proposals for channels. And then they winnowed it down to about 100. A lot of them are people you know. I mean, Madonna's doing a dance-oriented channel. Shaquille O'Neal is doing a kind of, I don't know, Shaq kind of comedy channel. There's some writers of well-known TV shows. For example, Anthony Zecker, who created CSI for CBS, is doing a sort of night gallery-like show. Amy Poehler is doing a channel. So there are quite a few sort of celebrities from the old world that we already know. And then there are some of these YouTube partners, sort of homegrown stars like Michelle Phan, who has a very popular beauty tips channel, who have gotten one of these advances in order to sort of, you know, have the money to create bigger production values and more elaborate scenarios.
Now, in terms of advertising, we're used to seeing TV peppered with like 30 and 60 second ads on the compute. YouTube, we're used to pop-up ads. What kind of advertising will appear on YouTube channels, or is that clear yet?
Well, it's not really clear yet. I mean, YouTube would love to get, you know, 30 second or 60 second long ads that people would watch. I mean, the big difference is I think that you're going to always have the option to click away from the ad on YouTube after a certain amount of time. And there, the proposition to the advertisers is, well, yes, it's true that we're not forcing people to watch your ads the way we are on television, but when people don't click away, you know that those people are very motivated, you know, potential customers. Also, we know their information. Because this is all delivered over the internet, you know a lot more about the people who are watching your ads than you do about the people who are watching your ads on television. You know, you tend to know their history on YouTube, at least. You might know some of their social friends, particularly if they are linking their YouTube stuff to Facebook. And then you can get into their purchase histories and stuff like that. So there's potentially a lot more information and potentially a much more sort of motivated audience. But you do have to get people to watch the ads. And that actually might not be a bad thing either, because it might force people who make ads to really make a great ad, an ad that you just really want to watch. And particularly the first 10 seconds of that ad, which is that part that you're going to watch before you have a chance to click away. If you can make something really super compelling, you know, that's a win for everyone, because, you know, you get an ad that you like to watch and the advertiser gets you. In fact, the most viral of all videos, the quickest video to a million views on YouTube is the Old Spice. It's an ad. It's that guy, that Old Spice guy, doing his thing. And I think this is another thing when we look forward. I think the distinction between advertising and programming is probably going to get a little blurrier in the YouTube future.
Right. And of course, the fact that advertisers can get all this data about the individuals that are viewing their stuff, as you said, I mean, maybe even who some of their social relationships are, what their viewing habits are, is kind of creepy to some people.
It is kind of creepy. But, you know, it's kind of creepy when you write an email and Google has got ads that are keying on words that you put in your email right next to, you know, your personal email. But, you know, you get used to it and you're willing to make these trade-offs. You get Gmail for free and it's supported by ads. And, you know, you say to yourself, well, you know, hopefully Google is not going to misuse this information. That's the big question. And so you go with it.
I wonder if there's a risk that sort of the essence and appeal of YouTube, I mean, you know, the serendipity of finding a hilarious moment or a unique voice, you know, would be undermined by this whole new direction.
It's a good question. And it's true that one of the pleasures of YouTube, two of the pleasures of YouTube have been, A, the sort of anarchic nature of it, which, you know, in the early days just seemed so great that, you know, you could have this totally unplanned, you know, no one was in charge type feeling. So different from television. And then the other aspect of it was, as you said, the serendipity, the things that you would just stumble upon. And I think as these new channels come in and start getting popular, it's probably going to be less likely that you're going to stumble upon things that are totally out of left field because, you know, that's just the way that the site is going to be reoriented toward, you know, the hit makers and away from, you know, the random people. They'll still be there. But it's, I think, going to be less easy to find than it has been. And that would be kind of a loss.
Do you have a favorite channel, a favorite performer of yours?
Yeah, I love the Gregory Brothers. I think they're musically really talented. They're great musicians. It's three siblings and the wife of one of the siblings.
Just explain what it is the Gregory Brothers do.
The Gregory Brothers are looking around, actually what happens now is a lot of people send the Gregory Brothers YouTube videos that they have found that they think might work in their format. And if the Gregory Brothers see something they think will work as a sort of a musical piece, they'll take the person's speech, and run it through this machine that auto-tunes it. So, you know, it sort of sounds like it's sung and it has a kind of musical background to it. And then they'll sort of chop it up so that certain key phrases in the Antoine Dawson video, there was one or two phrases that keep coming back. And in the I Love Cats, it's, you know, I love cats, I love every kind of cat, becomes a kind of a chorus. So, you know, in the end, you've got a song. And it's also a fun thing to watch. So it's a sort of a mashup of a video, like a music video, but a music video based on something that didn't begin as a music video. So repurposed. That's the difference.
Well, John Seabrook, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here again.
Let's listen to I Love Cats.
This is my first attempt at a eHarmony video. I'm nervous, but I'm excited at the same time. So I'm just gonna start talking about what I like. I love cats. I love every kind of cat. I just wanna hug all of them, but I can't hug every cat. Can't hug every cat. So anyway, I am a cat lover and I love to run. I'm sorry I'm thinking about cats again. I really love cats. I'm thinking about cats again and again and again and again and again. I think about how many don't have a home and how I should have some. I think about how cute they are and how their ears and the whiskers and the nose.
John Seabrook's piece on YouTube is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You can find some favorite YouTube video pics of the Fresh Air staff on our website, freshair.npr.org.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we want to tell you about some fresh new work coming out of the venerable Haitian art scene. There's an exhibition currently on display in the United States, but those who sponsored it hope to do more than sell some paintings. We'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn our attention to another one of those YouTube videos gone viral. After debuting last week, it has some 5 million views and counting, and it has created laughter and some controversy. It's a spoof of, and I'm going to use some edited language here because not everybody wants to hear about this. I'm going to say it's a riff off the comedy line, Stuff, My Dad Says, or Stuff, Girls Say. This one we will call Stuff, White Girls Say to Black Girls, and here's a clip.
Not to be racist, but...
Not to sound racist, but...
Not to sound racist.
My grandma hates collards. Wait,
Is that racist?
Why isn't there a white entertainment television?
The Jews were slaves too. You don't hear us complaining about it all the time.
Is it, like, bad to do blackface? Is that still, like, a thing?
You can say the N-word, but I can't. How is that okay?
My best friend was black. I mean, she's still black. And we're not really friends anymore.
Oh my god, I'm practically black. Twinsies!
That's Francesca Ramsey. She is a 28-year-old graphic designer, comedian, and video blogger. She's had two YouTube channels where she posts her comedic skills and parodies, and she's with us now from our studios in New York. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been actually doing this for some time, haven't you?
For almost 5 years.
For almost 5 years.
I know.
And this one just took off.
I know. I mean, I think there are a few factors that made this one so popular. The other spoofs in the series have gotten really big. There's been an Asian take, a mom's take, a vegan's take, a yoga take. I mean, pretty much every facet has been covered. But I didn't see something that related to me. So I wanted to do something that I could identify with, but was a little different and maybe made people laugh, but made them think.
And just to give people a visual idea, you don a blonde wig in this video. It's really blonde.
Yes.
Is this based on someone or some people?
Well, the voice is actually based on a really good girlfriend of mine. And I hope, you know, she doesn't get a bad rap because she's really wonderful. And she's maybe only asked me about my hair like once. But a lot of the comments do come from my real life, whether it be people I've interacted with at work, college, school. I went to a predominantly white Catholic school growing up and had to encounter my fair share of awkward first moments with my friends.
Well, speaking of awkward, this is one of those things that has been a topic on this program before, which is hair.
Right,
the whole
of course.
Question of hair and, you know, friends and hair and what people are allowed to discuss with the hair. And there are some people who are going to listen to this and say, what, with the hair again? I don't want to hear any more about the hair.
Right.
But this is a big deal to some people.
Right.
And so I'm going to play a short clip, another from your series of videos of stuff white girls say to black girls. Here it is.
Can I touch it? Okay, I'm already touching it a little.
Is this real?
Is this all yours? Wait, it's not real? It is. It is. Okay, sorry.
So happy.
Kind of feels like a Brillo pad. Oh, did that hurt? Oh, sorry. Sorry.
You guys can do so much with your hair.
Kind of feels like Cheetos.
You know, we were watching this as a group. There are a bunch of us in our office, a diverse group, watching this in the office. And I'll just put it this way, that some people were just laughing out loud from the first word.
Right.
And then there were some, I can say it, red faces, I think. Some people were saying, I've said that to some people.
Exactly.
So tell me why this is funny and why do you think it evokes that response?
I think that it just depends on what side of the dialogue you're on. I chose to use the camera as kind of the POV of the black friend. So, you know, if it's something that you've experienced, it's like you're reliving the experience and laughing at how accurate it is. And if you have actually said that to someone else, it's kind of like you're stepping into my shoes for a minute just for this video. And suddenly you're thinking, oh, my goodness, how uncomfortable would it be to have someone just petting me like a dog? So I think it's funny because it's real and it's honest and it's silly when it happens to you. But I think it can be embarrassing for people to confront the fact that they might have crossed the line with some of their friends.
We're speaking with Francesca Ramsey. She is a blogger and comedian, and we're talking about her YouTube video that has gone viral, and we're calling it Stuff White Girls Say to Black Girls. Now, you know, there are people who think this is hilariously funny, but there are also people who think it's
I think that's ludicrous. I think the thing to remember is that, yes, this is based on my personal experience, but I also did it as a spoof of the meme Stuff Girls Say. So in that series, it's not some girls, it's just girls. And it's meant to be taken as a joke. It does not represent everyone the same way Stuff Black Girls Say does not represent everyone. So this is, you know, my take on that meme. But I think because it is a racially sensitive topic, people, when they don't understand, they're more quick to say, well, then that's racist, because if a white girl was wearing an Afro wig, people would be really mad. And I don't think that it's not honestly meant to be offensive. It's in good fun. It's light-spirited. The people that have said these things to me, I don't believe that they're racist. I believe that they maybe are just a little culturally sheltered. And that was my objective, was to make people laugh, but to make them double, like think a little bit and say, oh man, maybe I have done that. I shouldn't do that next time.
You know what's funny though? It's just, it seems to me that a lot of the cutting edge humor around race is on YouTube right now. You know, a lot of the network sitcoms, and I'm not going to mention any by name because, you know, who needs that?
Exactly.
But a lot of the network sitcoms have been criticized for being crude around race, about being stupid around race.
Absolutely.
And not just this season, but the past season or two. And yet the cutting edge, the humor that many people really find kind of fresh and appealing is on YouTube, and it's self-generated, although yours
right.
is, I just want to mention this for people who haven't seen it, is the production quality, the editing is still pretty high. I mean,
thank you. I did all of it myself.
Well, congratulations.
I'm
just wondering why you think that is.
I think that's for a few reasons, and I also think it's great that you brought that up, because I think the way that race is presented on TV has kind of put us in this situation, because for so many Caucasians, and not just Caucasian Americans, all backgrounds, a lot of times we gain our knowledge from TV, and so we say, oh, well, Black girls on TV act like X, Y, and Z, but you don't. That's so weird. What is that about? So for me, at least, as an actress comedian, I have found that when I sometimes go on auditions or I get pitches for parts, I say, that's not me. And so that's what I try to do with my content online. I try to show who I am, but I try to show something that people will enjoy because they can relate to me.
Okay, one more question, Francesca.
Sure.
Can I touch your hair? Just kidding.
sure. I will set up a little booth for you so you can teleport to New York and you can touch it all you want.
I was just kidding.
I know you were. I know.
Francesca.
But I'm still offended.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Francesca Ramsey is a video blogger and comedian. She joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.